Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia returns home to Moscow for a belated Christmas with Zach. She considers the impact of having resigned her position on both reservations, recalls the nightmare of being forced into abortion. I imagine that disease colonel is positively feminine. Had she been whole, would she have eaten her peas or smeared them on her high chair tray or thrown them across the walls at her brothers? What would have been Brett and Zach's attitude toward her, toward having a sister, toward having a disabled sibling? Would it matter to tell them I'll argue to my death for a woman's right to choose, but that I want every woman contemplating the years of her life without that expired daughter or son to know you never get over it, that every year around the 1st of June a tiny girl appears in some form exactly the age Anna should be? From the rose a sympathetic friend sent for years 1 and 2 with a card attached that simply stated, "She's with you, Mom," to the 3-year-old in some stupid movie called Twist of Fate in which Steve Martin suddenly acquires a daughter, to the tiny slip of a girl in actual ruby slippers standing at a Moscow, Idaho sandwich shop ordering a root beer, who turned to say hello to me and when I asked how old she was said, 5. To the grocery clerk talking about his 12-year-old girl, me gasping inwardly, swallowing the aching knowledge that 12 was the age Anna soon would be, that I would go straight home, drop my bag of groceries, leaving the ice cream to melt and fall into my bed nearly comatose with anguish until I felt I might cause the sun to implode. No one to reassure me I did the right thing, and all my liberal friends could say was, "You did what was right for you. Your first duty is to do what is best for you." To that I say, bullshit. Sometime after the first wave of cramps, I fell asleep. I awakened to Mark leaning over my bed. The recovery room was tiny, a dark alcove no larger than a cell, room enough for a bed with its clean-smelling linens and a chair. I asked how long I'd been out. 1.5 hours, he said, his snowy blue eyes never meeting mine. I overreacted to the sedative. Maybe I was lounging in my subconscious, suckling my baby girl. A marvel my breasts didn't ache with milk afterward, or if they did, I don't remember. Perhaps it was too early in the pregnancy. Perhaps something in that narcotic cocktail made it dry up. The LPN came in with a stethoscope and blood pressure cuff. Finally, she said, we were starting to worry. Sometime afterward, Uncle Gus died back in Indiana. He was Daddy's best friend, and as a child growing up, I thought he was the most interesting person in the world, next to Grandma Hattie and Grandpa Darnell. Gus managed the gas station where Daddy moonlighted, but eventually opened an auto repair shop in his own garage. He died in his sleep in a rented house he shared with my Aunt Louise. He was the kind who gave horsey rides on his knee and who smelled of Camel cigarettes. His skin was dark and tight as leather. I always thought of him having absorbed all that auto grease. He called me birdseed because once I ate a box of it. Daddy inherited the 70 El Camino Gus babied for the last 20 years of his life. In June of 1994, on the day Anna might have turned 4, after I'd already begun work on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation, I asked Vernon to take me on his Harley to a place in the mountains above the town of Coeur d'Alene to help me hold a memorial for her. He'd written a poem comparing me to a girlfriend of his who'd aborted their baby. I'd written my own called The Pearl. We burned them both alongside with sage and sweetgrass and the bark of virgin cedars while I banged my nose purse drum. The day was warm. The early grasses of Idaho summer whispered, mocking the vacant feel of my skin and organs, exhausted as if they'd expelled a baby. The combination of Uncle Gus's death and word about Toby Perez's horrible highway death, Zach's troubles, Vernon's drinking, and Anna's would-have-been birthday sucked me into a dark pool of coping. I stared at Derek Covington's bottle of broken pieces of colored glass, which I carried in my pocket. I began to believe I could heal people. I began to believe I knew the future. I began to believe those preacher prophecies had come true. I began to consider whether my patients staying alive at Lapway and dying after I departed were evidence of my abilities. I believed a fire in Lewiston that burned several buildings was allowed to occur because I had left and taken my protective energy with me. I believed the white deerskin medicine bag I gave Zach would keep him safe from Mark's anger. I believed the campfire painting I'd given Brett would keep him from harm as well. And I almost believed a Coeur d'Alene woman put a curse on us, and that my mother's ensuing psychosis and the ghosts of settlers that came to inhabit her and my father's houses, my own systemic candidosis, and the sudden onset of illness suffered by all my staff at the Towhee Medical Center was because of the cosmic battle I was waging. I'd created evil by putting myself over the well-being of children. And Margaret, the LPN, was wrong. I remember everything. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I had just left another two-hour first meeting with a man from Spokane who brokered mortgages for a we-don't-care-what-your-credit-is-like brokerage. His name was Gerald. He claimed to be 46 but looked 55. His left ear had a tiny vacant piercing. He dyed his hair. His front teeth were false plates and shone overly big and white. It was 7 years since his last divorce, 2 since his last long-term relationship. He wanted to be married, said he was ready to risk it one more time. The question I ask myself, he said, is can I be whole again if it doesn't work out? I wondered why he would engage in anything that rendered him unwhole. Wondered if this meeting would render me unwhole, tolerated coffee and a walk along deserted streets strewn with after-winter trash and gravel, while I listened to him tell about his childhood sexual abuse. I knew it was time I stopped imagining the milk of human kindness was ever going to pour from the personal ads, but I couldn't help myself. Around Valentine's Day each year, I started, cautiously at first, then compulsively, as winter merged with spring, certain it was the year he'd find me. The Spokane Arts Weekly, The Imaginer, had so far printed 4 irresistible notices. It was always the language that snared me. So 4 times I dialed a designated 900 number at the rate of $1.99 per minute to listen to Kenny G or Carlos Nakai in the background as the gentleman tried to align himself with a marketable image. Each voice sounded cautious, emerging from my telephone as vulnerable, wonderfully sensitive and vulnerable, which is what I thought I, as a late 20th century woman, was supposed to crave. Look, you have to cease this nonsense, I told myself. You are too old for chasing romance, are trying to mature to pragmatism in other areas of life. Those little gambles were nothing more than Saturday morning weakness. The man for whom I was looking was not behind snippets of typeface. He was not so incapable of maintaining a relationship that he risked himself in the local alternative press. The man for whom I was looking was probably solidly in the wrong relationship, devoted and reliable, his disappointment reduced to a pin dot deep in his psyche, staying on for the sake of decorum, for the sake of not hurting anyone, purely for the sake of commitment. I told myself it was immaturity that had me seeking fulfillment so far from home, that I still held juvenile belief, faith, and acceptance, that confining myself to relationships with paternalistic men had kept me childlike, that even at 41, I remained a slow-moving conveyor belt. I'd been bitten and bitten and still was not shy. I still believed in American men, believed in the inevitable deaths of patriarchy and misogyny, believed in a well-heeled, dependable male human who peered from within his own truth. Even though Daddy insists American men don't think about women anymore. You sure don't hear them sitting around talking about them the way you used to. Too much has happened. Too much of this, you know, this stuff, he once told me over the telephone. Are you talking sexual harassment, Dad? I asked him. Well, whatever you call it, he said, you can't look a woman sideways without getting a lawsuit strung up. The problem is you, the mortgage broker said, seated beside me on a creekside picnic table. The problem is you. Happiness comes from the inside, not someone else. He asked for my phone number. I stumbled over excuses, requested time to think, told him I was not as ready to date as I imagined. My brain warped against the intolerable image of him lounging satisfied in my bed. This is your last time, I intoned. You will not do this again. I walked the man to his car, left him alone beside it, and I drove. South to Steptoe Butte, the site of the Coeur d'Alene battle with Colonel Wright and his troops, now a Washington State Park just west of Highway 27, midway between Tico and Oaksdale, wheat towns in eastern central Washington which run a nipple line separating the Columbia River Basin from a bubbled plateau known as the Palouse. Steptoe Butte is a mound of earth that fists out of the plateau, covered by Oregon adrift, volcanic ash from Mount Mazama, millennia deep. Ash turned to mousy brown loam heaped on the Idaho Rockies, freeing Mazama to become Crater Lake, to generate a fortune as a national park. I hiked to the top, hoping to discern connection between the model landscape of my hopes and the wealth of a place born of Earth's anger. Named for the same Palouse tribe who alongside the Coeur d'Alene's battled Colonel Wright and his men, the Palouse is a quadrillion tiny Steptoe Buttes, an infinitesima of up-and-down walnut fuzz green, parched corn yellow, buff, saged, roan here and there a bluff of dusty pine, mint to taupe, graphite gray edgeways turning solid under the wheels of rare traffic. But even this description is inadequate compared to its surrealism. And if I cannot portray the imbroglio, the mass of confusion that underlies, created, and is the Palouse, then how could I justify why, once again, I had landed in a situation that disrupted and confused my own inner landscape? Perhaps that is why I was drawn to it, because chaos feels at home even with ancient buried chaos, the reverse of that Bible story about putting old wine in new wineskins. I had dreamed the night before of a shadowy Middle Eastern man, an emaciated Jesus, of handing him a bunch of webby grapes, dark globules, mysterious purple concords like those on Mom and Daddy's backyard vine at the house in New Albany. Dark like handfuls of sin, bitten in places then healed over, as though by a groundhog or woodchuck. Some curious furry creature with long, exact incisors, similar to the one that once bit my school-age Aunt Ava, only a few years older than I, garnering her the attention of my daddy and her daddy, my Uncle Gus, as they unrolled cigarette butts retrieved from the ashtray of Daddy's 39 Ford coupe, the tobacco then mixed with spittle to form a poultice. In the dream, I was angry at Jesus because of his attitude toward grapes, because he boastfully turned water into wine, a miracle that so blatantly skips over the grape, the heart of a wine's life, and so, indirectly, the reaper, keeper of the vine, the long year's work of nurturing and harvest all for naught. I lectured Jesus about the condition of the wedding wine. It was too quick, becoming itself from water, rather than enduring the ages and processes required to transform grapes from the vine. I challenged Jesus, just this once, to bypass the miracle, take my grapes, and make them into a bottle of wine. Matters of the heart can be deadly. During the time I was director of community health programs for the Coeur d'Alenes, I had one patient on my personal caseload. Kelly was a non-Indian, the only person living on the reservation with AIDS, and the only person I had ever known with the disease. Although Kelly was not a patient of the Towhee Medical Center, he had long been a friend of Bonnie and Paula, the two nurses on my staff, and knowing my interest in HIV education and prevention, they took me to meet him right away. He lived with his partner, Robert, in a trailer east of Highway 95, down one of Towhee County's main roads, surrounded by wheat and farmers, good old boys who for some reason tolerated the presence of these two men. Kelly was the homemaker and Robert the breadwinner, earning his dollars as a nursing assistant at a long-term care center in Coeur d'Alene. I was drawn to Kelly because he reminded me of Mom. He was tiny, perhaps 5'2", with mild cerebral palsy that curled his left hand and limped his gait a bit. When I met him, he was in a phase of dyeing his meat-colored hair blonde. "It's good to take charge of your own dying," he quipped, and moved in an unconscious, delicate way, like one of the blue butterflies I'd seen around the park sign at the Grove of Ancient Cedars where Leonard Wohoban sent me to gather bark before I left the Nez Perce Reservation. Vernon was 6 months behind me. Brett and Zach were in LeGrand with Mark. I'd moved into Lydia and Paul Yupnovich's caretaker's apartment. I was in the loft surrounded by hilly farmland to the north and west, groves of State Forest Ponderosa to the south and east. My sole duty, weekends and holidays, was to look after a herd of great, pale-maned workhorses, prize-winning Norwegian fjords in various shades of chamois. It felt good to be living away from the verge of Idaho, out of the vortex of its mountain mentality, within spitting distance of a city. However mundane, Spokane at least had a blues club, a symphony, a professional theater, even national touring acts. Lyle Lovett and Jethro Tull among the handful I paid to see. And once, an evening of chanting by Tibetan monks at the Met, although I admit I left at the intermission, it seemed gross to me, selling spiritual secrets just to keep a lifestyle alive. You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need. What if they must vanish in order to make room for the next higher order of being? If they were about the spirituality of the planet, wouldn't resources come to them? I had not yet made my decision to leave the public health service, but Kelly kept reminding me life is short, that we only have this tiny spot of time allotted, and if we fritter it on things that don't resonate with us, what then? Aren't we obliged to develop ourselves to benefit the world, our species? Aren't we, as Moose said, charged with clearing our medicine bags to give our medicine for others room? And doesn't that mean taking care of our own needs first? Those long afternoons of iced tea and Kelly lounging on a redwood chaise lounge with a reflective panel perched on his chest to maximize the benefits of the sun's rays, he thought he might as well look good, even if he was going to be a corpse, set me to thinking. Kelly said his only passion was other men, and he'd loved every single one he could, from his birthplace in Mormon, Utah, to the wilds of North Idaho. "Get out while you can, sister," he said. "If it's not turning your crank, get out of it." In his next breath, he asked me to support his decision to stop taking his meds. "I'm taking 7 medications 4 times a day," he said. "I'm at a point where I'm tired of fighting month to month." He was taking nearly 30 pills a day and smoking marijuana just to get cravings to eat. A few weeks before the end of his illness, and I've always thought this is what brought on his final bout with pneumocystis pneumonia, Kelly and I went to see the Broadway production of The Sound of Music with Marie Osmond. It was a celebration, his decision to give up the bucket of meds, and I, despite being up for promotion to lieutenant commander, had given 6 months' notice to the U.S. Public Health Service and the Towhee Medical Center. I had a plaque on my office wall that said, "Towhee Medical Center Supervisor of the Year, 1994. Another that said, "U.S. Public Health Service Citation with its ribbon and gold lapel pin." And one that said, "Area Director's Award for Exceptional Performance." Some days I thought they'd close in on me, as if to mock Kelly giving up his life for whatever the afterlife is. 3 weeks after The Sound of Music, Robert and I sat at Kelly's bedside, a hospital bed rented and set up in the living room of the old trailer they shared, watching him pretend smoke drinking straws because he just couldn't break the craving even on his death day. Kelly looked at me and asked, "Do I have the death mask?" When I said yes, he politely asked me to go home. He died several hours later. He had written his own eulogy, had asked me to read it at his memorial in the town of Coeur d'Alene the next week. He titled it, "Living with the Idea of Dying of AIDS." If I were to have written my eulogy at the time, I would have called it Dying, an idea to aid living. It felt like death. It all felt like death. The end of everything.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
Patricia looks for love among the personal ads. She visits an AIDS patient on the Coeur d'Alene reservation who has decided to stop taking his medications and allow himself to die. I dated one man from the personals for 3 months. His name was Harvey, and he worked as a maintenance man in a hospital in a mountain town in North Idaho. Before I met him, he appeared in my dreams as a rabbit, easy enough to translate the metaphor if you know about Jimmy Stewart and old movies. In one dream, a little girl with blonde curls wearing an Alice in Wonderland dress came to me and asked if I would help her father. She led me to him over dry, flat desert land to a place of skulls and death. His right arm was missing, torn from its socket. How do you apply a tourniquet to his shoulder? The first night I stayed with Harvey, I saw the girl in a picture hanging along the up stairwell, congregated with framed photos of her brother and sister, baby faces, toddlers, school years, Christmases. Alice was Harvey's youngest daughter. He talked for hours about his children, about having grown up in the deserts of southern Oregon, and about the illness and death of his younger brother and his father's subsequent suicide, about his mother who afterwards supported him by waitressing in a Chinese restaurant with red vinyl booths and sculptured velvet wallpaper in a village called Lakeview, about living over the restaurant in an apartment that had once been a whorehouse. He played the guitar and sang songs for me, songs he had written. Then I slept with him in the bed he once shared with his wife, who left him to marry another maintenance man. After sex, he told me about the hospital secretary with whom he was in love, ballyhooed his boyish build, his uncontrollable hair, as the reasons he could not attract her. I passed the remaining pre-dawn hours turned away from him, imagining myself a great sow with a litter of suckling pigs, staring at the night and its motionless gash of a moon through the sliding glass doors of his second-story deck. What a wonder it must be when two whole humans come together, like Earth and 70-degree air, neither erupting or impacting the other. Sometimes I think we should return to living as humans did before Jesus' age, when people sat barefoot on stones, a time before language, when fire was the only poetry, affection traveling without symbol, a time before the first woman had to raise children alone. Perhaps language evolved out of feminine fear. Otherwise, wouldn't people have existed joyfully without words? Without their accompanying templates of expectation? If the men of my history were more like the planet, dependable as the seasons changing colors, perhaps I wouldn't be at this place in life, seeking predictability from those detached and wandering the personal ads. If I am unmarried all this time, does it make me a spinster? How long before I buy a dog, traipse to Europe with a singles group? How long without sex before the hymen closes, before the deflowering reverts to flowering, before the shadow falls long, dark, and cold, and the bud closes, then shrinks to a stob, then to the dead, lifeless stalk of the winter before. The top of Steptoe Butte was 3,612 feet into the sky. Approaching 500 million years of age, she was the older mountain, the Steptoe, rising from a bed of younger basalt. This was my spirit as I saw it, me jutting bodily out of the soul of a child, still young, inexperienced, still chasing dreams. Steptoe was lonely, too, her flock of smaller mountains and hills smothered, engulfed millions of years ago by unconscionable lava floods, molten rock from underground hundreds of miles away. Only Steptoe, the largest, remained uncovered, isolated in her grief, surrounded by stone-cold lava as it fell prisoner to ice age deposits of loess up to 200 feet deep. This was eventually called the Palouse, some of North America's most fertile ground. Another man I met through the personals told me that after his wife left him, he became convinced he was a great healer in the manner of Christ and went around to nursing homes laying hands on people. No one stood from their wheelchairs and cartwheeled or did baton twirls with their canes, but people did claim to feel better after he'd been around, so he kept it up. The man's last name was Reber, which he said means keeper of the vine. The divorce left him feeling like an arm had been torn off, like walking through his own grape fields, dried up from no water. In the film, A Walk in the Clouds, a family in California sustained a fatal loss to their vineyard thanks to a fire. Luckily, the future son-in-law had the foresight to dig out the orchard's taproot before heat pierced the heart of it, killing the mother vine, and so the family has a place from which to start. I don't think Mr. Reber managed to save his taproot. He tried to kill himself and was so damaged as to be awarded federal disability payments. His attempt was pretty gruesome. He was driving along I-90 near Spokane and saw a Nike billboard that said, "Just do it." Thinking it was a message from God, he veered his car at 65 miles an hour across two lanes and into a retaining wall. He said he was pissed when he came to in the ICU. When I met him, the scars looked fairly old. His face was a patchwork of contracted skin and muscle. He had a tremor strong as Parkinson's and leaned on a cane and was all of 38 years old. Last summer, Daddy and I were digging post holes for a dog run. Here was a man who had suffered hard luck. He was 13 when Grandpa Darnell was sent to prison and charged Daddy with fending for Grandma Hattie and three younger siblings, and with farming the tobacco, sugar cane, and corn behind the rump of a mule in a single-tree plow. Daddy barely got to finish eighth grade. Grandpa Darnell's crime was one of lust and passion, his conviction a mystery to all. He was loved and respected in his mountain community. No one could believe he'd ever touch a hair on anyone's head, much less a girl young enough to be his daughter. It's a story I don't know much about, since, of course, no one will tell it. From there, Daddy met Mom, and she immediately became pregnant with me, and so at the age of 20, he married a girl who was the victim of the very crime his father had committed. He worked his way from plumber's helper to apprentice carpenter to journeyman, moonlighting at other jobs, pumping gas, remodeling houses of the well-to-do, just to make the ends of our family meet. Then at 50, the company he'd worked for most of his life went belly up, and the owners were forced to admit they had not been paying Daddy's pension. Too passive to sue, Daddy one by one drew out his IRAs until he found a job as a laborer, climbing the roofs of buildings, hammering nails, installing doors, piloting the placement of floor and roof joists. And then one cold day in 1992, all those Big Macs and Grandma Hattie's lard biscuits caught up with him, and he suffered a major heart attack while working on a roof in 5-degree weather, working for a rich man named Tucker, who refused to provide medical insurance for his handful of employees. As much as I have grown to hate the commerciality of modern medicine, I am thankful for the little clot-busting agent known as TPA, delivered into the arteries of my daddy in the ambulance on the way to the ER. Thankfully, they didn't withhold it just because he didn't have the means to pay for it. I felt him watching me as I plugged those damn posthole diggers into the yellow Indiana clay, aware of the miracle that was him being alive to teach his adult daughter this new skill. And I was aware of the irony of this work, how I was forced to cut through roots and dig up rock in order to meet my goal, how I must go deep if I am to have posts solid enough to hold a structure, that structure intended to hold a life. And so I thought of Mr. Reber and Vineyards and the Keeper of the Vine, wondering why no one tells you it takes time to nurture a taproot. How poor are they that have not patience, Shakespeare wrote in Othello. What wound did ever heal except by degree? Or that your vines may not prosper. The new vineyard may be just a twig, or it may be bigger than a fleet, or it may be vast and never bear a single fruit. But then, this is counter to William Jennings Bryan's attitude, who said, "Destiny is no matter of chance. It is a matter of choice. It is not a thing to be waited for. It is a thing to be achieved." Does the trick then fall to hypervigilance? Do you stay up nights anticipating the very fire that will destroy the vineyard in the first place? I don't know. I could have saved my marriage. If I had awakened at 5 a.m. to jog for an hour, shower, dress, do my hair and makeup, get breakfast for the kids, do a bit of housework, then go to the office, come home at noon to fix lunch, and spend some time with hubby, who by this time is up from his morning sleep after having worked the swing shift, go back to my job to finish my county rounds as a public health nurse, stop at the gym for chest and arms or legs and back or whatever day it is, make dinner, take the kids to soccer or basketball or softball practice, bring them home, cook dinner, do another load of clothes and 30 minutes of housework while they watch TV, get them on homework while I spend 30 minutes on the bills or mowing the lawn or pulling the weeds, get the kids in the shower, read them to sleep, do an hour of yoga, then go to bed myself, wake up at 2:30 a.m. when hubby comes in for sex, then nap until 5 a.m. and get up and do it all over again. If I had been the kind of woman who could do all that and change my nearly 5'8" large-boned frame to 5'2" and bird-boned, I would still be married. No flame would have ever reached my vineyard. Daddy told me a story of how as an infant he survived a tornado. A cyclone, as we called them back then, he said. It wasn't at the mountain shack where he was raised, but in his granny's log cabin where he was born. He was only about a year old, but he says he remembers being unable to get out the front door for all the felled trees, and that a neighbor's woman's house was lifted away, but she was left sleeping in her bed. I guess I feel like this. My marriage to Mark left me with only one choice, only one way out, and I took it. The years have left me like the woman in the storm. Everything has been taken, but I am intact and have a place to lay my head. People asked me prior to my heading out on this camping trip why on earth I wanted to come up here when spring is still mixed with winter and to such a lonely place. One well-meaning male friend even said, "You might as well hang out a shingle that says you don't need a man." Well, that is part of the trick. Since the divorce, I have learned to do everything alone. Taxes, traveling to Europe and major U.S. cities, taking Brett and Zach backpacking in the Idaho Rockies. Nighttime alone in the mountains was the only thing left to face. Somehow proof that I still have untapped potential. The truth will hit me on the way home. I did not want to get divorced. Marriage is full of salvation and iniquity, water and fire. But when children are born into it, there is no room, so long as anyone is being bloodied, for quitting. People tell me leaving was about my survival, about being a fire on a higher mountain. 10 years afterward, however, it is I who have not recovered the cleaving. I can't put it behind me. I can't forgive my self-centeredness, extinguish the guilt over the abortion, and I watch Mark, married to a gal with pre-adolescent boys, and my sons dating girls with intact families, and grieve and grieve and grieve. Although tonight I do not know it, in the morning I will decide whatever part of my heart I came to collect from this anxious new generation of waters is no longer here. I will heat bottled spring water and the shots of espresso I brought with me on the small kerosene burner I bought 13 years ago for Mark's 34th birthday, stand drinking it and staring at the ashes of tonight's campfire, wondering again where was my brain that I could assemble espresso shots but forget firewood, pack the burner but go to bed hungry for want of food to cook. I'll seal the Rubbermaid honey bucket I brought in case there was bear sign, abandon my campsite to drive 72 miles west along the Minum and Grand Ronde Rivers to La Grande, the town where our family lived, 2,600 miles away from Mom and Daddy. Where Mark once dropped a yardstick into a backyard drift of snow and we didn't see it again until April. The same yard in which Clipper lay collecting flies on her pelt in the hours before her death. Where my sons wore graduation hats as they transitioned to kindergarten from preschool. Where they played soccer and baseball and attended talented and gifted programs in public schools. Where Brett marched in the band and worked on the school newspaper and Zach once came sliding across the stage on his knees playing jazz with a bubble-making yellow plastic saxophone. Where I discovered D.H. Lawrence and Joyce Carol Oates and gave up Stephen King. Where I learned the difference between hawk and falcon, sparrow and meadowlark, ponderosa and juniper. I also do not know that I will decide to sleep over in La Grande, renting the same $25 a night mom-and-pop motel called the Quail Run, where I always used to stay to save money when it was my turn to travel for child visitations, that I will set my Tanqueray and tonic water on the bedside table and drink until I vomit, while Mel Gibson in The Patriot fights his demons in the form of the British and lament silently over the Cherokee he massacred and buried as a result of an earlier segment of the same war, courtesy in-room HBO. And at some point in the evening, after I've already had too much to drink, I will notice the two Walmart paintings of White Buffalo Calf Woman and her medicine pipe hanging over my bed from either side of the narrow gauge room. I will wonder for months what those two paintings meant, whether although I have long since left the Indian Health Service, the lesser of my blood ratio is once again speaking to me, whether the healer in me is calling me back into service, or whether the time has finally come for me to heal myself. Physician, heal thyself. Sitting here by the Lost Dean this dusk in 2001, I feel the ancestors out there watching me. Grandma Hattie, Grandpa Darnell, Toby Perez, Uncle Gus, Anna, reminding me it's a quick life, a mere drop of water, a single mote of light. Perhaps it is they luring me to turn my head toward the river, and then the stars to show me, nothing has changed, you are the same as always. As if in evidence, something new settles over my camp, a certain turn of the light. My tent appears encased by aura, and I feel recognized as a familiar by the rustic harmony of these woods. Perhaps I have only come here to remember the land and I are one, both sentient force, to let the earth clear my head and heart. My stack of cordwood beckons, courtesy the U.S. Forest Service and spring storms. I wad balls of newspaper, arrange a teepee of kindling and two fingers thick branches in the fire ring, wait for these to get going before I place the log and watch dead moss sizzle and pitch ooze in rusty dribbles, wondering who has the photo of Brett lying next to this very ring, the glow of campfire reflected off his face. He might have been six. The tinder ignites in a whoosh, and I recall Mark's camp joke. White man, build fire big, stand far away. Indian, build fire small, stand close. My fire isn't all that big. Remembering Zach stashed his new autofocus 35mm camera in the glove box, I grab it and snap shots of my blaze from several angles, turn and expend a similar amount of film on my pitch tent. Proof that, at the very least, somewhere along the way I learned about the mysteries of extracting fire from wood, an unforgiving but more or less reliable means of keeping a lone, mostly white woman, warm.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek. Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.